Welcome to the Brilliant Podcast. I am talking today with Klee Benali, and we are going to talk in the general theme of season three of the Brilliant Podcast. And we're going to talk today about colonization, and really what we're driving at, or what I hope to achieve, is to reconcile an indigenous perspective, or a not indigenous perspective, with anarchism. And, you know, this has been a broad project of mine for a long time, probably as long as I've been an anarchist. But clearly there's some details to talk through and to work through. And Klee and I, for those who might be surprised to hear, have actually been pretty good friends for a couple years. And so this conversation will be less formal than you might anticipate, because we'll have to take lots of time to make fun of each other and whatnot. So welcome.
That's why you're really calling me.
Yes, right.
This is a roast.
I want a public opportunity to make fun of you. Yeah.
Oh man, I am not prepared. I will tell you that.
So, I mean, really, to get started, and to get started like at high speed. If an anarchist revolution were to happen tomorrow, who would have to move and how quickly?
The first response is, you know, where are you talking about? Are you talking about the general so-called project of the United States?
Yeah, Turtle Island.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you look at the complexity and the diversity of the indigenous peoples and nations, or nation expressions of nations, I think that that would be something that, if folks were acting with integrity to with an anti-colonial position and understanding, then they would be they would have to consult with and build the response and answer to that question with the indigenous people whose lands they're occupying. Otherwise, it's just perpetuating colonialism. And so I think the question really asks, you know, if there is truly a revolutionary movement that overthrows, because, you know, the definition of revolution that I understand is the overthrow of one power and imposition of another. And that's, by, you know, for the most part, why I reject that term. Why I reject the term revolutionary, because for me, I'm an abolitionist. I believe in the abolition of these systems for the liberation of Mother Earth to be free, and for our autonomy as indigenous people to be able to determine our lives as they have been since time immemorial. And so for me, you know, the sort of like interesting institute, the way people try to institute revolution, I think there would have to be a lot to come to terms with in relation to indigenous people's lands they're on. And that would be, you know, over 565, and that's just the federally recognized tribes, but the indigenous people whose lands that folks are on. And that, so that question would be answered 565 different ways.
Well, it's interesting you frame it in that way, because I think that one of the things that, you know, anti-authoritarian politics doesn't do well is it doesn't consider sort of how do you get different types of people into conversation with each other. In other words, the spokes council model or the consensus of Occupy, I guess the assembly model. Neither of those are particularly great ways to get engaged actors into conversation with each other. They're a great way to get sort of like an undifferentiated mass into a conversation with itself. But I think that idea that, you know, you would have to have like some type of table of, for example, 500 nations to sit down and talk about, you know, the three or four different positions that 500 nations would take, and then reconcile that with the position that, you know, anti-authoritarian political people would take. To me, that would be a real big problem that I don't feel like enough energy is used to consider how that would happen.
Yeah, and I think like we'd have to sort of break down or sort of unpack a bit of what you're imagining in this, you know, revolution. Because, you know, from my standpoint, you know, I would, you know, if there was a dissolution of the U.S. political body, you know, my sense, and, you know, of course, we're hypothesizing here, is that, you know, Dinebikeya or the Navajo, what is largely recognized as the political body of the Navajo Nation, you know, we would assert our, you know, autonomy or sovereignty in this region. That would be my hopes, of course, within the four sacred mountains that we have. And then we would enter into whatever kinds of agreements or negotiations, discussions, you know, with whatever other entities would wish to engage on either a political, social, cultural level. And that's the sort of way I would, you know, have a sense of that. And that would have to play out, you know, by and large in different, you know, areas as well.
Well, of course, but, you know, in asking you this question today, it's, you know, it's sort of funny because, of course, it feels like if you were 20 years younger, you would have answered in more of a hothead way. You would have said, you know, the white man's going to be sent packing and, you know, start building the boats now to head back to Europe.
Well, you know, actually, I think it almost was the other way around. I mean, that's sort of the Ward Churchill position.
Yeah, right.
You know, you know, it's a good agitational position. You know, 20 years ago, I was actually probably more liberal in my politics, more, you know, edgy in my punk rock, but, you know, my politics, I think, you know, I was still trying to figure out how to work, you know, and how, you know, talking a lot about unity and solidarity. And now I'm not afraid of drawing those lines and drawing those boundaries, but I think it's much more complex than that. You know, the knee-jerk reaction typically, or the reactionary position of settler colonizers is that they're like, oh, well, what do you want us to do? Just all go home? Like,
sure.
Well, right. You know, I feel like I'm a native person because I was born here too. And even if you hear people from the left, you know, espouse that kind of bullshit rhetoric, when the reality is it's much more complex and much more interesting than that. You know, I mean, the fact that that assumption is being made before there's any relationship that's built with indigenous people whose lands you're on. Like, I've had this conversation with people in the occupied land, Tongva lands of so-called Los Angeles. And, you know, that you know, this sort of left is always like, well, what do people want us to do? Just go, you know, go to Europe. I can't, you know, I don't know, have any sense of my lineage that connects me to that place. And I'm just like, wait a minute. You know, like you're sort of internalizing this, you're taking this very personally, but you've never built a relationship with the Tongva, the Chumash, the Kumeyaay people, the Ahachemin people, and ask them, what is your role here? What ways can you be with them? Because there might be a much more interesting response or answer. And if the answer is, yes, pack up, go home, then that is the will of the indigenous people whose lands are on, because that's what they need to do to heal their land or for their people, and that should be their prerogative. That's it. But well, the answer to me is much more complex. It isn't, because I think in some places it will be that Ward Churchill, you know, get the fuck out. In other places it might be much different, and I think that there needs to be room and understanding for that sort of diversity of response.
And of course, you know, where this does become complicated is that there are not a lot of nations that really represent a large percentage of the people that live in their ancestral boundaries. So yeah, we would absolutely really be talking about, you know, 1% of a population saying, get out in a hypothetical situation. And yeah, with very few exceptions, basically.
But that, I mean, the dispossession from land doesn't mean we're dispossessioned in our spirit, our mind, and our sort of, you know, cultural, whatever, ecologies, you know, so those memories, ancestral memories, still there, you know, that can be restored. There's no reason that they shouldn't be restored. And I think that that very well could be part of the process and should be. And it wouldn't be, you know, at the sort of, you know, handed down by some, you know, revolutionary struggle. You know, indigenous people shouldn't, and we should never be, and we aren't, an appendage to any liberation resistance or revolutionary struggle. And I think that that's part of the break that we have is that, you know, if anarchism is about, you know, in sort of, you know, one of the pillars is consent, then why isn't that being practiced in relation to indigenous peoples? Because the first thing and foremost thing is do you have consent to be on the land that you're on? And if not, how can you reconcile that? So the first steps of any revolutionary movement should be that, if it's in sincerity with an anti-colonial position or politic. But so, if they're trying to figure this out after the revolution, then, maybe it'll be much more interesting too. I mean, I'm not, afraid, or I'm not condemning the potential for insurrectionary struggle and immediate overthrow of the system. But
well, and the reason I bring this up is really because I tend to be fascinated with how we frame the work that we're doing and the goals of what it is that we're trying to accomplish and who we choose to work with. And, by and large, quote unquote, revolutionary actors, that they have a framing that they're using to talk about what their project is. So obviously an old stodgy framing, but one that totally exists, is that the active agent for any social movement is going to be the working class. And, nowadays the language that tends to be used for people who sort of talk in that sort of similar way is they say that some kind of unity of dispossessed people, AKA the internal colonies, that these are the people who need to be organized to change the world as it would be. Neither of those perspectives, which I think are the two most popular ones that I can think of, really seem to consider, indigeneity or the people who were here before as part of their program at all.
And that's the point of that statement, because it implies that we're an appendage, as opposed to, and this is why I take issue with this, anybody who espouses or just, sort of postures as revolutionary. And when it comes down to it, there's this same tension that we have with Marxists, and why I think with class struggle politics, we take issue from an indigenous perspective, or folks have taken issue historically from an indigenous perspective with Marxism, is because we all don't want to be proletariats, nor should we be. This concept of the lumpen proletariat and looking at indigenous people as the sort of peasant class and so forth. It's problematic in that it's condescending, it's patronizing. I'm sort of oversimplifying right now without getting into details of the tensions, but I think that's part of it, is this assumption. I mean, because when we, when we just state that, how do we imagine, revolutionary anarchist struggle, in my mind, I don't see it as, I should be seeing it as, a indigenous-led movement and struggle, but that's not the case. If we look at the demographics of revolutionary anarchists in this day and age, for the most part.
Well, actually, it's sort of another way of approaching the same topic, I guess. When we refer to both of those systems that I mentioned, whether one being sort of a Marxist class struggle position, the other one sort of being a Maoist, organized, dispossessed sort of model, both of them use their logic in any conversation with other actors. And so I guess the first question would be, and you sort of started to intimidate it here, but the idea of, if we were going to talk about a scenario that said, what would throwing off colonization look like from the inside in a country that's as massive as this one, how would the framing of that even begin?
I think you just said it with that question, because that is the question we should be asking ourselves constantly. This is like, and it sort of gets into what I was really hoping, because I know you were planning on coming up here from the occupied lands, the so-called Phoenix, Ocamil, Autumn territories, and then something happened. I don't know what happened. Maybe you ran out of gas. Your hitchhiking finger got too sore.
Spiritual gas, at the very least.
I had this horrible image of the smell of your spiritual gas. Yes, running out of spiritual gas. Wow. Has this conversation really gone to that dead end? But on the next podcast of brilliant podcast, we're going to be talking about how to make sure that your tank of spiritual never ends. What I wanted to talk to you about when you're here is this thing that I'm playing with right now, and I would like to explore, and I'm taking a risk by putting it out there because I would like to have this conversation with other people who identify as Indigenous anarchists before it really goes out there. And it's basically taking a position against an Indigenous anarchist theory in asserting that there is no Indigenous anarchist theory and perhaps there never should be. And the point would be to actually attack Indigenous, you know, attempts to create an Indigenous anarchist theory.
And what do you mean by that?
And so the thinking, without getting too colorful with my words and taking up too much time, and this is why I'm taking a bit of risk, and I'll share a little bit about what I've written, and maybe I'll meander through it without hopefully trying to ramble too much. But here, I'll share. So what I've sort of drafted is that our thinking is informed by ancestral knowledge grounded in a cyclical earth view and refuses most all useless forms of European-oriented induced domestication. We believe that there should only ever exist a tension with all political ideologies that have emerged through colonial relations. This isn't a fundamentalist or puritanical position. It is one that urges against the contours of intellectuals, academics, and armchair revolutionary theoreticians primarily, who desire to flatten our earth view into categories that are too stifling for our desires. Their pastime is building walls within walls of concrete structures where they can hang their accolades and intellectually manage those below. We are wild, which is not to say savage, primitive, or identify ourselves on a rung of a ladder of quote-unquote civilized privileges slash hierarchies, but that our existence is organized in cycles that will never be fully coerced into the geography of settler colonial knowledge systems. We find more affinity with the juniper and sage that grow through impossible sandstone. We locate ourselves in the springs where our ancestors' footprints have worn a path like an umbilical cord. And that's where I get poetic, blah, blah, blah. It's a little artistic. But so just sort of taking the position of rejecting sloganeering and tokenization, that's the trap of the politics of recognition, and acknowledging that after a theory is solidified, then that's when the banners are waved. And we don't, again, taking a position that we don't wish to, and I'm reading sections of this without getting into too much detail, but that the assertion would be that we don't wish that Indigenous anarchism ever be a flag that's planted anywhere on our Mother Earth. In this way, we could say that we see anarchy as merely an antagonism of the means and an Indigenous liberation as the ends. We have no interest in fidget spinning process of exploring an anarchist identity or being a hyphen. And that's actually something that comes from you as part of why I wanted to talk about this, because you talk a lot about, you know, the hyphen nation and adjectives of anarchism. And then continuing, we are not an appendage to any liberation or resistance politics. We are children of our Mother Earth and relative to all her beings. This is our full and complete identity that we will not segment or section out on the chopping block of quote unquote US or any other identity politics. So the conclusion towards an affinity with anarchism is only made due to the, and this is sort of my position in my exploration of like understanding how I've come to call myself an Indigenous anarchist, is because usually I say I have an affinity with anarchism as opposed to anarchist identity. And so the point here is the conclusion towards an affinity with anarchism is only made due to the anti-Indigenous calculations of every other political proposition. While we appreciate the overture to shed our cultural bondage and join the proletariat program, or the gesture to own the means of production, or the seduction of negation and individualism, and this is, I also want to talk to you about that, because there's a range of tensions regarding individualism and collectivism, you know, how does that factor in the pivots that we have with, you know, this sort of collective cultural identities as Indigenous people, but then continuing, our past is so intimately intertwined with our future that we see no benefit in those arrangements. Our social relations have had little distractions between what we want and how we have lived for generations upon generations. Old dead European minds aren't our fascination. We aren't tethered in to any ideologies of materialism. Our flexibility is that we certainly don't believe we can vote our way out of this crisis. And there's a range of other things that, I mean, a lot of this isn't stuff that's new. It's just trying to synthesize some of the discussions and coalesce it into an anti-position, I guess. What are we rejecting? And that's been done before on different levels. But the idea is to just, you know, categorically attack the position and attempt to coalesce indigenous anarchist theory. And there's more to it.
Well, I mean, that's obviously the first question is, who do you think you're responding to? Like who do you think is doing this thing that you're crying out against?
Well, I was the first target, and it was named in the beginning, is the intellectual sort of elite that institutionalizes thought. And so the idea is to sort of, you know, free the expression and the understandings from those institutional restrictions.
So are you referring to academics who have written on this topic?
I would say for the most part, but that extends down, because I think that that's the flow of power of a lot of thought and thinking, which theory is based around.
Hmm. Because I think that, you know, obviously, to the extent to which I see myself reflected in what you're saying, and you know, other pieces that sort of I've either published or have been around, it seems like almost everything I've seen that has called itself or is thinking about this problem says pretty similar things around not wanting to create another ism or another hyphen. So I'm just curious as to like what was it that you read that inspired you to think about this and to take pen to paper?
All the comments from all the range of websites that are out there.
Like regarding a particular controversy from the last year, or is this an angular way of talking about the Atossa controversy, for instance?
It could be, but honestly, that's just like, I think, one component to the larger mm-hmm. discussions that have been going on. You know, I mean, everything from green anarchy, anywhere that there's been a little bit of an engagement with the fascination of indigeneity, the fascination of decolonization, I think that's where the attack needs to happen, because this propensity to fetishize and then sort of render things more a, you know, personal project or, you know, sort of an appendage again of, a position that, you know, sort of asserts itself as, you know, the liberatory, the revolutionary, the resistance. And I think that would be the point, is just like to, you know, maybe sort of like, you know, we're already at the margins regarding the position that we're in with radical politics. And I think this is pushing the margins farther would be the point. Because, you know, the idea is to address this. And I guess part of the target would be the radical communities, if we can put quotations maybe around that.
Sure.
And then provide a space for liberal tension. Because there's an interesting thing in indigenous communities where we assume that we all have the same politics, you know, and other people assume the same things.
Right.
In the past 10 years that I've seen it, people have been more intentional around it. Like, we can look to flashpoints in history, like AIM, and people can say, oh yes, you're either AIM or not, or you're AIM or right. What else? You know, there hasn't really been a something else, or you're with Ward Churchill or not. And
right.
that, you know, and Ward Churchill, in his identity being attacked, you know, the sort of anti-indigenous position, you know, has been assumed with throwing out him and all his work for the most part in some circles. And you know, I think that, you know, a lot of the critical thinkers, and Vine Delore being one of them, you know, has very intentionally, being an academic, being an intellectual, has also interrogated himself and attacked himself to tease out you know, a meaningful way of Indigenous people to work towards liberation. And I think that would be, this would sort of be an extension of that, but to push more for an Indigenous audience, you know, primarily as well.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, obviously, you know, as you're saying this, this sounds like a very exciting article to go in the next issue of Black Seed, since obviously this is exactly, you know, the kind of conversation we're trying to start and have. I think one of the challenges of publishing around this set of topics is how very small the number of people who are concerned with these topics are. And it's interesting that you just sort of mentioned as a throwaway decolonization, because it feels to me like decolonization has absolutely been the mechanism by which a much broader type of audience is engaging with these topics. And yet it seems so inhuman. It seems so outside of what I understand is like human behavior. And you know, and yet again, it seems like a very coastal sort of way of framing the situation. You know, again, I was just back in Michigan where, you know, where my family's from, and no one's talking about decolonization there. You know, and I'm referring to like all the tribal newsletters and papers that I'm exposed to when I'm there, like the very sort of like related to the academy conversations around decolonization isn't on the menu yet. And so to, you know, to me, part of this question and the painful part of this is, this conversation isn't happening anywhere near the level of, for instance, Black Lives Matter. So the question that it relates to is how do we, on some level, like make our concerns more broadly known, more broadly understood, and on maybe on some level more popular than they currently are.
That's a question.
Yes, that's a pretty big question.
Okay. No, I sorry. I'm sort of harassing you.
No. It's yeah. Totally fair.
And you know, and I know I'm not saying anything new. And I you know, part of my response is that my position, and you've heard this, you've heard me say this before, is that I'm trying to promote attention between to differentiate between decolonization and anti-colonial struggle. And part of the reason, and that's where sort of this is being driven, this yep. approach yep. is being driven from as well. You know, cause there's that, you know, that idea that, you know, we don't want to be patriots to any political social order, and it shouldn't be assumed that we will be, you know, as Indigenous anarchists, our loyalty is to where the mountains, you know, we could be colorful and say the wind, the rivers, the trees, the salmon, sheep, birds, horses, spiders, etc. And it's not just colorful, it's not just poetics, that's the actual reality, you know. Yes. I mean, sometimes I just get tired of saying it because it sounds like a cliche. Yes. You know, especially in these formats, you know, we have much different conversations around a fire or in person. You know, and the idea that the destination of our anti-colonial struggle isn't a nation state, but it's liberation and sort of like reasserting how we can approach our understanding of, you know, the struggles that we face today, in looking at, you know, how we can be forces of nature as Indigenous people. And I think that to me is like, you know, I don't want to define what Indigenous anarchism is. Sometimes it's much more interesting to define what it is not, but that's also a cop out. And so I just want to like open up that conversation deeper. And I credit you for truly, you know, being at the forefront of that for years, you know, and that's why I was looking forward to having an in-person conversation a little bit more. Cause I feel like me personally, I've grown and sort of like, you know, helped, you know, through some of the readings, the work that you're doing and just the observations I've had. Had a little bit more, you know, personal growth regarding these issues, and so I'm looking at expanding and exploring that more with other like minds. You know,
you're being very kind, but I think that part of that question that I really love, and I think that it's hard to talk about, especially in this sort of a recorded, like for an audience of strangers, like. I mean, you know, I've been around green anarchist type people for a very long time. And when they ask questions like this, I find it incredibly embarrassing. In other words, when they ask the question, how can we be forces of nature? because it feels like there's some sort of break there that has to be mentioned before we can really start that conversation. Like, in other words, I don't trust most people that I meet to even ask that question.
Yeah, and that's the position I want to be at, but in a way that's sincere and a way that's not just like pan-Indigenous and doesn't recognize the complexity and diversity. Because that comes back to the question of like after the revolution. Yeah. You know, who do we consult with? Do we, you know, find our spokespeople and our spokescouncils, you know, and how do we do that? I mean, that was the question that was the impetus for forming tribal councils by the federal government in its, you know, colonial imposition in these territories. So, you know, I'm not interested in repeating the past, you know, and not to say we wouldn't trust people who come dressed in black and waving, you know, a black flag more than, you know, a star and stripe flag. But, you know, if people are just looking for more stars to add on their flags, that's another question, you know. I have a few other things that I wrote, and I'm sort of like throwing this out there because I want to hear your response. And you don't have to be kind either. Maybe this is just our opportunity to fill up each other's spiritual gas tanks. But there's going to be a meme out there for that. But yeah, just adding more, like just looking at this, what I. In this piece that I'm drafting, it's like, you know, we offer that in the incompatible brilliance between understandings of anarchism and Indigenous existence, a space is revealed where we can shed the poisoned skin of a formal political entanglement in the dominant social order of the isms. Our aspirations are already well articulated by original teachings. No theory or postulation can substitute. This is not to infer that our ways are rigid, but to break the dams imposed by colonial stunting and let the rivers of our ways of being flow once again. And this is sort of honestly probably just taken from something you wrote, you know, and just reinterpreted, you know.
I slightly recognize the density of what it is that you're saying.
Yeah. And without breaking those, you know, metaphorical or, you know, physical barriers, the addition of any politics still risks stagnation in the waters of theory. So our existence is guided, but it's also fluid. No river should live as a lake if its waters were born to flow. And that's why, you know, just sort of getting into that discussion about force of nature, you know, that certainly existing theories should be explored. But, you know, there's this overwhelming masturbatory tendency to reduce that exploration into a lifestyle project or at its worst, a nonprofit campaign. You know, so, you know, how can we disentangle or just explore and interrogate the social relationships that have become so complex that we just have lost ourselves, any recognition of ourselves, and that our ancestors would never be able to recognize ourselves because of how complex, you know, we've made them. But, you know, it's like we've started weaving these webs and forgot that we learned to weave from Spider Woman as Diné people, but ultimately still we are not spiders, you know. Yeah. And so there's a lot of, you know, I don't know. I've been called in the past anti-intellectual, and I'm fine with that, because I am anti a certain kind of intellectualism. And most of it is academic and it's institutionalized because it has been born and it exists in an anti-Indigenous foundation and structure. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's where the part of this rejection, you know, I guess, is for me, and where the, not necessarily the audience is, but it's the folks who are also desiring, you know, because desiring to see how they can be in this world through those rungs in the ladder of academia. I mean, there's in the biggest cliche that we have as Diné people is that song "Go, My Son." You know, it's like, you know, there's this sort of myth around Chief Manuelito, who was one of the signatories of our original Treaty of 1868 after the Long Walk, which is our forced march of suffering and internment for 4 years in Fort Sumner from 1864 to 1868. And when that treaty was signed, you know, one of the Natanis there, Manuelito, had, you know, stated something about, you know, that our people and this is codified in the treaty with the federal government, need to, you know, climb that ladder for education and make a better world. And so there's that horrible song. It's utterly cliched, but I mean, that's the reality that we face on and off the res as Indigenous people, urban or res. And that's the impetus. And so, you know, sort of breaking that impetus and that sort of part of that cultural fabric that, you know, we've entangled ourselves in. But yeah, I'm sort of being redundant here, but I'm also searching for some of your responses.
I mean, what's funny is you're basically talking around the fact that a lot of pan-Native issues have been hallmarks of liberal politics. And you know, you sort of alluded to this earlier, but just to be specific for people who don't know this, Vine Deloria was a very liberal political thinker. And as much as he's referred to by a lot of radicals, because, you know, at the heart of a lot of the things that he had articulated were sort of radical positions. In point of fact, he spent his entire working career basically doing liberal shit in the context of being a government lawyer.
And I mean, I guess that's part of the clarity here is in what I meant. I guess we've had so many conversations, I'm forgetting that if we're podcasting this, your audience might miss the context. And part of that, the point I was getting to with that is saying that, you know, there's a lot of folks assume what our politics are as Indigenous people, that we all care about the earth. And, you know, we also have our assumptions as Indigenous people going into a lot of these circles. And that is changing and has been changing for some, you know, time. Like I said, you know, over the past, you know, 10 or so years, I think there's been a great, brilliant tension that's fed into that. But the idea is, like, you know, we can look at people like Russell Means, and if we look at just purely his politics, well, he was a Republican.
He was a Republican, absolutely. And supported the Contras.
Yeah, I mean, so just, you know, sort of like breaking those assumptions and creating this tension to really address the liberal Indigenous establishment as well.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, is something you have a lot more exposure to than I do. And by and large, the reason that that's the case is because that, to the extent to which there was like a Native infrastructure, it has been really decimated over the past 30 years. Meaning that tribal councils and just infrastructure throughout the country is less and less and less as each year goes by. And by and large, that's because most of these institutions are funded by government grants and whatnot. And as those disappeared, you know, a lot of those, institutions disappeared. I assume that that's a little different where you live, but in terms of where I'm from, pretty much everything that was there in the 70s is gone today.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of the dynamic.
And, you know, so then you're actually in the context of negotiations or conversations around people who seem like they're politically active, but some of them are just doing it for a paycheck, and others are sort of doing it based on the information that they received through government institutions, which, you know, by and large, you know, we barely discussed how much bad information a lot of our decisions are made on. I think specifically in the context of the Dene, you know, when you think about nuclear power and the different political winds that have blown and that absolutely influence people, because you only get as much information as you get.
Yeah, and that's definitely part of the struggle here. I mean, nuclear colonialism. I mean, we identify these categories of colonialism when ultimately it's, you know, there's sort of two categories that define it, resource and settler. And that's, you know, breaking that down and understanding that, you know, helps to sort of also break this sort of, you know, fetishism of decolonization, because anything can be decolonial. I throw up in my mouth a little bit every time I see like a decolonized, you know, your diet or hashtag, you know, kind of stuff. I'm just like, or like the most recent one being decolonize your medicine. I was like, wait, the medicine the medicine. like in some ways you're sort of like assuming colonization of the medicine when the medicine is itself, you know, we like from a traditional cultural standpoint, as Diné people, we make offerings to the medicine. We have certain prayers before we gather. So we have to go and approach it and offer that name, a sacred name, and make an offering And then, you know, we harvest, and then we pray specifically to that medicine for the purpose, for the specific patient that we have, for the ceremony or the herbs that they're going to be treated with. And so, you know, to hear somebody say, oh, decolonize the medicine, it's like, wait, what happened here to the medicine? Did they forget their name?
Yeah.
Did they lose their name? Or is it us? And I think that that's part of that, you know, just absurd disconnect.
Well, you've probably heard me refer to this in the past, but there's this fundamental assumption at the heart of all Marxist ideologies, including anarchism, that humanity, to be free, has to go through a historical progress from primitive communism, you know, through being peasants to being industrial workers, and then finally they're prepared to be communists. But that way of thinking, that historical materialism by different names, exists in a whole bunch of different places. So this is a total example of that, where, you know, the first assumption, if we're talking about decolonizing our medicine, is that we have to make sure that our medicine is completely colonized, and then we can begin the process of decolonizing it. Where, you know, as we know, some of the most explicit exploitation that's happening of resources in the world is the preservation of, for instance, the Amazonian rainforests because of all the quote unquote medicines that are waiting to be exploited.
Yeah, I mean, we can certainly talk about monocropping. We can talk about genetic modification. We talk about the manipulation of our medicines, but I think that's different, you know, in relation to what is occurring and what the movement, you know, of the sort of the social movements of decolonizing medicine or decolonizing diets, or I don't know what.
So I want to give you an opportunity to spell out, and I will try to engage with you critically on this, because of course, you know, as you know, I disagree with your language here. So you're talking about the way you express it is a tension between decolonization and anti-colonial struggle. And, you know, of course my tension with it is that your language is both clumsy and very activist in orientation, but I want to talk about how you sort of got started thinking about framing this in a different way and whether it's been successful or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the point is, again, just to reiterate, that anti-colonial struggle is the process of attacking colonial ideas and structures, whereas decolonization is something that is much more internal, as it's been interpreted and applied now.
Right.
You know, I think if we're talking about Frantz Fanon's Retro to the Earth, you know, decolonization, he was very much, you know, connecting that with armed struggle and liberation. But what we've seen is sort of a white or red washing of decolonization, to the point where it's like anytime, you know, a tribal council builds a school, you know, that could be viewed as an act of decolonization, or, you know, something that much more interestingly happened with, you know, Oprah, you know, this sort of sensationalism around Oprah potentially running for the highest position of authority in these occupied lands of this. There were in the comments that I had seen on social media, people were saying, you know, if you're attacking Oprah, you're basically perpetuating a colonial position, an anti-black position. And so I had witnessed in a lot of these discussions, people talking about in sort of policing language. So the point I was getting to is just that, you know, criticizing folks who are tearing down or attacking Oprah as, you know, what I would, you know, identify as ruling class elite, you know, desiring to be in highest position of authority in the so-called United States, you know, as being, you know, a colonial rhetoric, which to me was just bullshit, because they weren't recognizing that ultimately her aspirations and current position of power in this country is colonial. And she's still reaping the rewards of colonialism and seeking to position herself in an extreme position of power in the settler colonial project. And there's a miss, you know, it's just like completely missing the mark. So the idea is to just, you know, ultimately reject that notion of decolonization work and assert that we can engage in a configuration of anti-colonial struggle that is just about attack. It is about attacking colonial structures and ideas, and the idea is to work towards a position where instead of this sort of like oppression Olympics or the oppression hierarchy of oppression, we're saying, okay, for folks in LGBTQ two-spirit struggles, like if your struggle is against anti-heteropatriarchy, you know, recognize that that's brilliant, beautiful struggle, and you have your, you know, autonomy within that, but you have to be able to articulate your relationship to Indigenous people whose lands you're on. So have an anti-colonial position, but recognizing that that attack against heteropatriarchy can be a component of anti-colonial struggle, and so forth with any of, you know, these configurations against systems of oppression. And I know that all of that jargon right there, you know, is activist-y. And that is, you know,
I guess
the tools that I'm working with, but
I don't want I don't want to just call things activist as a blunt insult. Like for me, the point is to say, where is the strength and the weakness of that sort of attack first or that, politics of the street sort of attitude, and where does it fall apart? Because by and large, the thing that I experience when I experience people who take those positions is that that position is fantastic 1 to 3 days a week. 1 to 3 days a month. And that the rest of the month, they sort of take a breather because it's so exhausting, so emotionally exhausting, so physically exhausting to sort of attack. And so, you know, for me, the project of my life has been how to take, you know, shared values and figure out a way to do this as a thing I do every day. That's part of a more holistic life path that isn't so focused on what feel to me oftentimes to be very superficial victories at best, and most of the time chasing after superficial victories. So, you know, earlier today, as you probably know, I have a bolo or a house filled with people, and someone was talking about, you know, there being certain numbers of like new people who are coming to the struggle. And, you know, one of the other indicators that's constantly ticking up is how many windows have been attacked. Well, what does that look like if your goal isn't just attacking windows? What does that look like if your goal is to, you know, be part of an atmosphere of hostility towards the existing system all the time? And sometimes it doesn't look like, you know, shouting from the tallest buildings, a rhetoric that nobody understands.
Well, so first, the metrics isn't based around broken windows. And I think that also, you know, begs to understand and explore what we mean by attack. Because I think that is where the interest is. Attack, and I guess one of the best ways that I've come to sort of explore and address this is in this recent piece that I published with a group of folks on indigenousaction.org, addressing Indigenous Peoples Day. We put out a piece, a zine, in zine format called Uprooting Colonialism, The Limitations of Indigenous Peoples Day. And the last two sections, I think, are relevant to this. You know, we talk about uprooting colonialism. We talk about how anti-colonial struggle means attack, and ways to do that specifically. You know, it's, I think that what we're trying to move away from is, yeah, the social justice warrioring, and the sort of, you know, activist trademark branding of, you know, the work that we need to do to undermine these systems, to ensure that we are moving towards our liberation and not just sort of doing these masturbatory self-fulfilling projects. You know, and there are standards that we can set, you know, the historical watermarks that we have benefited from, that we can gauge. And those are truly the metrics, in my opinion. And they aren't just metrics of smashing windows. They're metrics of our life and our existence. You know, and some folks say, because I in these conversations, some folks say, well, resistance is life. And I say, wait a minute, you know, it's not a passive process too. You know, we have to understand that, you know, in this, what do you mean by that? Are you just giving yourself a pass and way out? Just, you know, going to the movies is like part of it. Not to dismiss or minimize that, not to say that I don't, because again, as I mentioned way early on in this sort of agitation against in indigenous anarchist theory, that, you know, it's not puritanical, it's not rigid, you know, it's fluid, you know, it's understanding that, you know, we're living, you know, interesting, creative beings. But if I can read maybe a couple of sections of this, because I think they might be relevant.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, to this, and maybe we can, you know, go back and forth, because I think ultimately, you know, we might find more that we could agree upon in relation to, you know, the situations that we're in and what tactics or actions would be appropriate for us to take. I mean, not everybody's roles, and this is sort of common discourse. I don't think we need to get into the sort of 101 components of these discussions regarding, like, well, not everybody's role is to build bombs, because you don't want somebody who's, you know, an expert at, you know, publishing or, you know, doing letterpress and design, building bombs, because what could happen, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, just recognizing the range of different ways that we can engage and what this sort of, the commitment that we have, which has to be first and foremost a commitment of our spirit, and the rest follows from my standpoint, my teachings. But so anti-colonial assaults are decisive strikes that aim to achieve one of three things: expropriate resources for your own survival, materially alter the conditions of power relations and geographic control, or three, actively sabotage and undermine the continuity of colonial power, resources, control, culture, and control. In short, it's something measurable, not simply a sentiment or word game constituting an agreement in word, not deed, easily forgotten and ignored tomorrow. We're not trying to join in with settler block party or even take it over. And this is a quote from Kin Balam. And so they further add, and this is from the piece Uprooting Colonialism Beyond Indigenous Peoples Day. So further, to be anti-colonial means to act and attack. It's not just a bunch of solidarity photo ops and masked up defensive actions with junior settlers driven by their colonial guilt during their Rican warrior adventure. For the colonized, life is war. We are under occupation and siege from all sides at all times. Even the would-be accomplice is and always has been yet another contingent potential traitor. Just as much so, we, the colonized, all have the potential to collaborate in our own genocide. The difference does not matter. A matter of what position we take. Genocide is always the situational condition of our struggle, and we are forced to respond accordingly. We don't get a second chance at making mistakes, because fundamentally either we are an existential threat or they are. It's their cabins or our teepees ablaze, but one way or another, something is burning. I could go on, but the point I want to get, and that is a strong position. That is, you know, as you would assert, the breaking windows, smashing windows thing. And, you know, I guess, you know, part of me doesn't want to let that go.
Let me actually respond to the content of what it is that you're talking about, because the strongest piece in terms of what you've said so far, the piece that I appreciate the most, and that where I feel like there's the most amount of work that is to be done, is that the critique of quote unquote decolonization as a critique of personalization, or to put it more bluntly, the way in which people who are referring to decolonization refer to it as some sort of personal journey. I am absolutely on board with that as a way of seeing people who are using that terminology in the project that they're trying to create. And so for me, the way in which people think about themselves as individuated, important, beautiful snowflake type people, like, this to me is an important problem that an indigenous perspective by and large, has some important lessons and some things to teach. The second part of what it is that you're talking about, the part about what does it look like to do meaningful, impactful action with other people, to me is happening prior to the context of how do you find those people. In other words, if we live in a culture that's deeply motivated by I and solving all problems in the context of how do I solve this problem, for me the broad issue and the issue at the heart of you know why there aren't more people doing anti-colonial struggle is that it's extremely difficult to find we. And that those tools, the problem of how do we transition people from I to we is a deep one, almost a fundamental problem.
And I think that's, I mean, we could go a range of different ways. My usual response to that is that's where, and why anti-colonial struggle needs to be differentiated between from decolonization, because I think we can actually sort of, like, for lack of a better metaphor, shoehorn in, you know, like these other, you know, anti-oppression projects that folks have, you know, combating different forms of systems of oppression, to bring a bit of a focus back to understand that it starts with the land that we're on and asking very simple questions like, you know, how can we be a force of nature to ensure and defend, protect, and, you know, or, you know, again, rejecting these activist-y words, but how can we be a force of nature to ensure that this land will be healthy, that we will be healthy because that land is healthy? And so, you know, that to me is that starting point, because we build that relationship to space, then that extends onward. Because as Indigenous people, you know, we don't assume a relationship to the land. We understand that the land has a relationship to us. You know, that's why we can, you know, grasp concepts like land trauma, like the land holds pain. So how do we heal that pain? You know, that's in interconnected with why there's no moisture here, why the lands, why the forests are burning, why the deserts are growing. And so, you know, building an understanding that, you know, part of that we is with nature and other beings of nature, and then building beyond that, you can't have that conversation without the Indigenous people who've lived there since time immemorial. And sure, some folks can meditate on it, or, you know, I don't want to get into sort of New Agey speak, but, you know, we have our concepts and understandings as Diné people in relation to how that knowledge can become upon. But, you know, that's part of that relationship building and understanding of who that we is. So, yeah, I think that's part of the disconnect and part of the hard thing to translate and understand in building around these struggles.
Well, I try to keep these conversations to about an hour, and that is an excellent way to wrap up this conversation for now. Clearly, I think that there's some other places in here where we can talk another time, but I just want to thank you for this conversation, because I think that we really have a good start, and probably you'll have a series of links that'll be useful to share to the text we published last year.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just appreciate the opportunity. Like I said, just taking risks, and, you know, I'm looking forward to the face-to-face conversations about this to build it out more. Because I think, and we didn't get into the ITASA stuff, but, you know, I think it's
not that important.
Exactly. It's a bit of a side note in relation to, like, what we, you know, have to deal with here.
No, for sure.
But I think those are important conversations to continue to have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.